6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. We have another fabulous show lined up today. Two of our great elected city leaders are joining me in the studio today. It's really an honor to have them. First, we have Madison Alder Maurice Cheeks. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've been trying to get you on my show for a long time. You are a popular man, so I'm so glad this finally happened.
Well, we live in the same district, right? We're sort of mutual constituents, and so it's exciting to get a chance to do this with you. Thanks for having me.
To talk about. Thank you for coming. And then we have Madison Alder, Barbara McKinney. Hello, Barbara.
Well, hello. How are you?
Wonderful. It's so lovely to have you with us today.
I'm excited to be here, especially with my unofficial mentor.
Oh, is that? Cheeks,
that yes.
Well,
that's flattering.
Lovely.
That's the same way that I feel about you, Barbara.
For a second, I forgot you said unofficial. I'm like, do you assign mentors on the city council?
We do, in fact. Yeah.
Well, so it's official, not even unofficial.
No, this is an unofficial.
Oh, that's unofficial. Not your truth. We don't assign mentors on the county board. We just make people think.
Oh
no.
We say, oh, you don't
that's
know what you're doing.
Good.
Best of luck to you.
No.
We're horrible.
That happens too often, right? That happens all the time with local
elected
office.
All the time.
We train people on how to run for office, and then we don't train them on what to do now that you're in office. That's a problem.
Yes, that is a problem.
That is so true.
That's a problem for, mm-hmm. I mean, that almost could tie into this whole conversation of that no one supports people
Absolutely.
Enough. But, really, elected officials our privileged class. We are excellent, excellent people. But this conversation today, we're going to talk about what's going on in the city of Madison, the increase of violence, and a really detailed, thorough proposal that Alder Cheeks, you and Alder Matt Fair, mm-hmm. Who could join us today. He's a school teacher, so he's off teaching. So hello, Alder Fair out there.
He sends his regards.
He sends his regards. Excellent. The two of you, issued, it's almost like a report. It was a multi-page sort of statement of here are things that we can do and that we should be doing to address violence. But before we get to the details of that, let's sort of take a step back. What prompted you? You know, we've had violence that happened recently in the city of Madison in the past, since really the turn of the year, since January, there's been three violent killings, all gang related. There's also been domestic violence killings in their own separate way, but three specific killings that were gun violence in public. And that really seems to be, your proposal seems to be responding to that. But in fact, your proposal has been months in the making, yeah. Responding to the bigger picture of violence in our community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we Alder Fair and I sort of affectionately refer to it as a memo or a report or something like that. It is unfortunately timely in that we do have a number of sort of current events related to gun violence that tie in relatively neatly with the sentiment of this report, to bring you all the way back, I mean, I was first elected to the city council in 2013, and I represent one of the most socioeconomically diverse districts in the city of Madison, right? So District 10 includes Midvale Heights, Nakoma, Allied Drive, Orchard Ridge, Dunn's Marsh, and Summit Woods. And oftentimes people say, whoa, that's such a big district. And, I think of it really as a snapshot of our city, right? You have folks that are making it, just several generations of sort of blue-collar workers, et cetera. You have some folks that are professors and, are less affected by some of these concerns directly in their community, but care a lot as it relates to the city. And you have some of the most affected marginalized communities in such as in Allied Drive and Dunn's Marsh. And Alder Fair and I started working together on this a few years ago, actually. You might remember there was a newspaper article that explained in 2014, Alder Fair's house was broken into. And this was one of the first times that he and I had a serious conversation about what are we going to do? Not specifically because this affected him. I mean, he was working closely with his neighborhoods anyway, but he and I had both had served on the Public Safety Review Committee together, and we had sort of a shared affinity for the importance of public safety as it relates to building a healthy community. And it started there. That's where our mutual bond was first formed, when we started working on PSRC, and this affected him up close, and we recognized that both of us, being Southwest Side Alders, had some of the most affected neighborhoods. But it expanded a year ago, when it was actually about this time a year ago, it was March of 2015, when we saw a rash of gang-related violence. Mm-hmm. You'll remember those conversations. And Alder Fair and I...
A lot of things at the mall, and yeah, where sometimes youth would congregate, but also the community would congregate.
Yeah. So Alder Fair and I started really putting our heads together around what are best practices, what can our community do to not only directly address violence as it persists, but how can we find evidence-based programs or initiatives that will sort of halt or interrupt the cycle of violence and crime that other communities have seen things work, and, you know, we have some programs that work, and, you know, how do we double down on that so that not only can we address what's immediately in front of us, but what we can reasonably predict is coming a generation from now.
Something you said at the beginning really sort of struck me, and I know maybe because I can sort of relate to it. I live close to you, and it really strikes me in the district, which you and I have overlapping districts, is that Nakoma and Allied Drive are really next to each other. There's a belt line in the middle, but these are neighborhoods that are complete worlds apart, and they are right there next to each other. And it's sort of fascinating sometimes how we're so close to each other, and yet there really is a tale of two cities, or maybe two or three or four cities, but really different perceptions of what is happening in the city of Madison. When you started having a conversation about violence, it definitely feels like some parts of the city and some communities, definitely communities of color, disproportionately communities in poverty, which in Wisconsin is disproportionately communities of color, are much more impacted and aware of what's going on. And then in the Nakoma neighborhood, in the Midvale Heights neighborhood where I live, and other places, I don't really feel they're as touched by violence. There may be people in there will disagree with me, but in general, they are not. How do you sort of deal with that divide?
Well, the fact of the matter is our community's too small to be regarded as problems over there facing those people, right? I mean, I think everyone in our city feels up close and personal the fear that is associated with violence occurring in public, right? I think, you know, everyone opened the paper that next day after we saw a shooting at a police station and said, whoa, I mean,
it's scary.
That's scary. I've been to that gas station, right? Everyone sort of has some sort of personal, and I don't mean me, I mean the global me.
I have been to that
right.
gas station.
Of course I have, right. As well, right?
Right.
And so I think that's a really important thing for us to recognize, is that these issues of crime and violence, while they are most acutely felt in black and brown communities, in, you know, these pockets within our community, the fact of the matter is this isn't a city that is big enough that you can regard that as not affecting everyone. And that's a strength. That's a really good thing, because our community is small enough that we can get our arms around it. We can feel some collective unity about the importance of it, rather than sort of marginalizing the concern and saying, well, you know, we're going to focus on these issues that we find more exciting over here, and we're going to let those folks over there deal with that. While I think there's plenty of people make the case that that's exactly what our city does, I think it is more evident than ever that we can't and shouldn't take that attitude.
Alderman McKinney.
Let me move into the conversation and widen the southwest side, because as you've described what's unique to Alder Cheek's district, I would move you to expanding to District 1. And when you look at District 1, we're starting at a very affluent High Point Estates, all the way out to Verona and Hawks Landing and those associations in between. But there is nestled in between there a pocket of black and brown people, Park Edge, Park Ridge, and so struggling with the same issues. And when
right,
you look
and blocks away from each other,
right,
literally.
And so similarities. And when you look at fear, it's also the perception of not being safe, the perception of fear. And so, what we have done and is to say that this community over here is worse than this community over here, and that further separates us. Mm-hmm. We really are looking at community-wide. We're looking at the community. We're looking at the city, and any initiative that we are moving forward has to take that into account, because if you don't, you are segregating even further, saying that this is their problem, but it's not really their problem. It is our problem collectively.
That's right.
So
absolutely.
I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
What made you decide on this proposal? And then, Barbara, you can chime in as well. I want to get your sort of the opinions of someone that was working on it and then the opinion of a colleague on the city council looking at it to really focus on gun violence in particular.
So not only does it focus on gun violence, it also focuses on youth gun violence. And so it certainly does take a relatively narrow band. But from our perspective, this is one of the most pressing concerns for our city as we evolve, as we have been and continue to transition to being a city that anyone could reasonably describe as being a sort of small college town, to a city that is rapidly growing, rapidly diversifying, and rapidly being faced with the challenges of urbanization. I think it's really clear that that our city, that our community is demanding that our leaders take a stance on important issues like this, like violence, like youth empowerment, like gun-related violence, in order to provide sort of modern answers, in order to learn and be proactive about learning from the work that other communities are doing that have been facing this for maybe longer than us, or have maybe made more significant steps towards stemming or interrupting these type of issues. I think our city's not at all content with the idea that we're going to continue to give sort of generation old answers to modern concerns.
That's sort of an interesting answer, because you go both sides. You sort of say, look, we aren't the first city to do this. There are answers out there that we need to look at. And yet I appreciate your answer at the end, as well as we need modern answers. So it's sort of looking at what's been done, but also trying to acknowledge that it needs to be respective of the current situation that we have.
Yeah.
The sort of interesting juxtaposition of the two pieces.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note in here that, I mean, so we have gotten plenty of feedback on the particular items that were called out in this report, right? We called out 9 separate things, and some of them are based on things that we're already doing in Madison. Some of them are based on things that we sort of envy other communities doing. But, you know, certainly there's an infinite number of, you know, what could be regarded as good ideas, right?
We sort of know what works sometimes.
Yeah, we sort of know what works, right? The trick is picking a few, investing in them, and investing them because we have the confidence of evidence to suggest that they work, and the political will and determination to say this is unacceptable here, and we're going to do what it takes to to halt this cycle, to invest in our own community, to invest in our future. Because, you know, as many have pointed out, that if we don't take proactive steps, 10, 15 years from now, we're going to be looking back and saying, wow, what happened here? And the answer to that will be that our leaders weren't proactive in addressing issues that had been obvious for 40 years, but we didn't have the will or fortitude or focus or commitment to invest in our own community as it changed.
Barbara, what do you see as sort of the key issues, and what was the response from colleagues on the city council about really focusing on gun violence and, as Mo is mentioning, youth gun violence, and really trying to invest in that piece of the puzzle?
My colleague articulated it very, very well, and one of the things that he said was, in 10 or 15 years, I think our city is at the tipping point. That's a term that has come up over the past few days, and I like that term because we are on the crux mm-hmm. of a tipping point, and it's not 10 or 15 years out. I see it as that urbanization is happening now. And when I look at community pockets, it's not just on the southwest side. There are other districts across our community Absolutely. That has pockets. And when we're looking at tipping points. And so as elected officials, we have the responsibility of sitting back and taking a global view of what's happening within our neighborhoods. I mean, it really takes intentional deep dive into looking at all of our neighborhoods and looking at where those tipping points are and making those commitments to be intentionally looking at those and investing in those. And so I agree. I remember when the West Town Mall was shut down, mm-hmm. and I was panic stricken because I was just there a couple of days ago with my little adopted daughter, and I was so concerned if I had been in that shopping mall when that had occurred. I mean, we go to the bouncy place and we frequent that mall, and I was there was a sense of fear that ran through my mind that young people would be in such a public place and use gunfire. And so one of the things is that when you shoot a bullet, you know, when you shoot a gun, that bullet has no name on. And so yeah. looking at what we can begin to do with young people proactively is critically important. So I agree with everything he said, and we are challenged now to say we have a problem. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I still have pictures on my camera of the chaos and confusion from the Ferguson shooting. And so mm-hmm. There are models out there that we as a city can pull from. And so it's not a package deal. We look at those models and see what works. And then we bring that into our own community and said, you know, this is what works for us. And we are at that point of owning this. And I would say that
yeah.
the city and the our constituents expect that. They're saying, where is city government on this
yeah.
issue?
Yeah.
And so we as a council, we as elected officials says, you know what? We're owning this. That's why it's critically important to put those steps out there, because we're past the time of talking and having gentle conversation. And so the public is saying, what are you doing next? What are you moving next to? And so we are owning that, and that's very critically important. So that's a shift in what we've been doing in the past.
I want to talk about the specifics of the proposal, but I have one sort of follow-up question. And Barbara, you've worked in criminal justice for quite a long time, advocating for better resources and better services. What is your perception of the change, if any, that has happened in this state in particular around accepting access to guns. It feels to me, as someone that doesn't have your history working in there, that access to guns is easier. We're more an accepted gun culture, concealed carry. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but is that relevant to this conversation, or was this inevitable? This isn't about concealed carry. Do you think there's a link there, or not necessarily?
So I'm going to shift that conversation.
Okay.
I'm going to shift that. And the reason that I'm shifting that is that for 10 years I worked with individuals who were incarcerated and moving back into the community. And I asked them the question is, when did you get started going down that path? And most of the individuals that I interviewed said that I was preteen, I was 10, I was 12. The first time I held a gun was this. I saw my brother shot. I saw my best friend shot. And so when we're looking at, so violence is always been there. And so when you have a young person who grows up in a situation in our culture of violence, I mean, access to guns, weapons, all of that, they grow up with it. And so that's one of the things that I'm seeing the shift to is that we must begin to go upstream to determine how did we get where we are. And the only way that we can really look at how we got where we are is start looking at juveniles and look at that culture and how they come up. And so I am encouraged that now we're looking at young people far beyond when they get to where all this violence started and start concentrating our resources on youth, young people. And so that's why I wanted to shift away from, you know, the gun violence piece. The violence has to stop. There are too many guns that young people at a maturity level that I'm upset with you, and the best thing I can do is to pull out my gun and start shooting. That's a whole culture that we need to begin to address and look at.
This is Carousel Baird. You're listening to A Public Affair. We're talking today with Madison Alders, Maurice Cheeks, and Barbara McKinney. Well, let's get into the nitty-gritty and the details of what we're talking about here. Mo, tell us a little bit about the heart of the recommendations. It's really, there's a couple different categories, but when I read through it, the biggest category is support for youth.
Yeah, absolutely. As Alder McKinney mentioned, there is an importance in recognizing that this is not something that starts all of a sudden when someone are adults. This is something that people get exposed to at an early age. At the same time that actually Alder Fair and I were making our public presentation of our list of best practices, we had a poster right to the side, and I called attention to it. I don't know how much anyone acknowledged it, but this poster was based on, I forget what university had sort of put together this flow chart of the cycle of contributing factors to violence and insecurity and poverty, etc. But one of the things that I was that we tried to outline there is that, you know, these are really complicated, multifaceted issues that, you know, are much more nuanced than simply someone has access to a gun, or someone is, you know, angry at their friend or wants revenge or whatever. I mean, this starts at an early age as people don't have security, don't have mentorship, fear the system, or don't have trust in government, or are exposed to abuse and violence and, you know, things like that.
Unstable housing, lack of
education. So absolutely.
That's sort of overwhelming to think, what can you do as an elected official on city government to address this complex system, which is, I think that's part of the appendix of your document.
Yeah.
I love the appendix of your document of, like, yes, this is a living, breathing, complicated piece. So then Let me talk about some of the specifics.
Right. So what we tried to do is identify things that are working locally, regionally, nationally, that have evidence to move the needle. Right. So we looked at Milwaukee has a program called the Milwaukee Peace Project. I should also point out at this point that that our city council has a really phenomenal policy analyst named Heather Allen, who did a tremendous amount of research.
Shout out to Heather. She's lovely. Tremendous amount of research
to pull these together. So called out the Madison Peace Project, which in a sentence is a program that a youth-led program to identify best ways within a given community to raise awareness and concern around gun violence, to suggest ways that youth can be a process, a positive force within their own community, within their own spheres of influence to sort of stop the violence, right?
And the idea that they have the answers because they're living in that world.
Another one, and this is one that certainly my colleague has experience and plenty of thoughts and ideas about, but there's a program in town called Communities Against Violence, sometimes referred to as CAV. Communities Against Violence is a program that helps to identify the sort of worst, worst offenders, the folks that are some of the biggest threats to our community, mm-hmm. identifies them, and sort of puts a program together to surround them with resources and say, listen, you're on the radar. You are a repeat offender. You're causing a great concern to our community. We don't want you to have to live the whole rest of your life behind bars. You know, if you have a desire to better yourself, to take steps to create sort of a legitimate life for yourself, our community is ready and willing to do that. To help you in being successful at that. And if not, know that we got the whole book to throw at you, right? So it's trying to...
It's a little bit of like a tough love philosophy.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tough love philosophy, right? So that program is underfunded today.
It exists now.
It exists right now.
And the city launched it.
It was the city of Madison that initiated that. Along with MUM.
It's really refreshing to see that in your proposal. So many things that I see, which are absolutely meritorious, are first-time offenders. Barbara and I both work on restorative justice programs. Yes. Mm-hmm. For youth. We work every day to pull youth out of the criminal justice system. These are youth that are getting in fistfights with each other, that are doing minor retail theft, minor things, but all incredibly worthwhile and very important. And your proposal deals with some of that, but to mm-hmm. also see your proposal acknowledge the worst of the worst, mm-hmm. they are also members of our community, and mm-hmm. we need to do something. Mm-hmm. That's hard work.
It's hard and complicated work, as my colleague can attest to. You look mm-hmm. like you're chomping at the bit on something.
No, it is. And I wanted to say that even those that are incarcerated, 85% of them come back home, back to our communities that live next door to us, that frequent the same places and spaces publicly that we frequent. And so it is really important as we redirect these resources mm-hmm. to make us have a safer community, that we address those resources to help those individuals who have caused such community harm. So I just wanted to ditto in on that.
Yeah, and we know that, you know, folks are going to get out and they're going to be faced with a choice. You know, every offender will at some point become an ex-offender, which is to say, you know, reintroduced to society. And as a society, we have to make a determination as to whether or not we want to create systems and structures that allow these people to re-engage and find a place as productive contributors to society, right? We say that they've paid their debt to society, so, you know, thanks for paying your debt, welcome back, we hope you don't find yourself in that situation. But we also know that a tremendous number of people engage with the criminal justice system, re-engage with the criminal justice
mm-hmm.
system.
Once
you know,
you're
the recidivism
in.
Rates are
yes.
really mm-hmm. high, and part of the reason for that is because if you can't see a way to provide for your family, to provide for yourself, to make it in this world legitimately, but you can see a way to do it illegitimately. You know, everybody's got
to
eat.
You have to choose something.
And you have to choose. And, you know, it's not acceptable to take a choice that that puts our community at harm. But it's also our failing as a community if we do not acknowledge that someone who has paid their debt to society needs a hand in reintegrating into society.
So how do you intervene with that? How do you write? And one of the favorite things that I love about Mom, there's so many things to love about Mom, where you, Madison Urban Ministry, where you used to work, Barb, where when I first got to know you, was the reentry simulation. I can't say that word off the top of my tongue for some, but really to, here's your life when you reenter. Okay, go find housing. Oh, well, you can't. Go find a job. Oh, well, you can't. Go find your special Social Security card that you need to take the bus to get you there, but you can't afford the bus, so you can't get to the job. And if you can't, I mean, all the things that are added to, also to disproportionately people in poverty. How do you find a job? Well, to get a job, you need access to the bus. You need access to this. You need, but all these obstacles, you even add that on when you're an ex-offender. And these are written into the law. These are, the laws say the landlord doesn't have to rent to you. The law says you don't have to get this access to this job. All these obstacles, they feel insurmountable. How do you try and chisel away at that?
Absolutely. I went through the simulation myself. And you can talk about the barriers and challenges that someone who's returning to the community have. But when you experience that yourself, and so one of the program models is returning prisoner simulation that Mom has sponsored for a number of years, and you get an opportunity to participate in that, which means that your identity is changed, and now you have to access community resources. And when I went through that, I was so frustrated that I wanted to give up. It was unbelievable for me to have to access everything that I had to access and find housing and find all of those things. At the end of the session, I was so glad that I could step out of that role and back into my real self, but it became an aha moment, and so I would encourage any
everyone
individual
to do that,
to
have
go
you done
through
it?
That process, because when you go through that process, you realize, well, these barriers and these challenges are real, and you say to yourself, my goodness, I felt set up for failure, and that's how I walked away. And so what are we saying? What we're saying is that we need to wrap our arms around providing resources for individuals who are transitioning back into the community. And what I have hear individuals say is that, I know how to do what I do. In slang, it means is that if I don't have any other resources, now I'm not talking about the ones who are critically, that's all that they're going to do. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about the individuals who want to believe and hope to change their life and the trajectory of where they're going. And so when they come out in the community and we talk about hope and the opportunity to rewrite your story and be a contributing citizen and pay taxes and those things, we've got to have those opportunities out there for them to do.
And this program is a piece of that. I mean, I will say I find it fascinating to go through the reentry. I hope that everyone does it, will flood the Mom website and go see, because they happen on a regular basis. Please go, everyone listening, and check it out, because it is sort of fascinating how frustrating it truly is.
Absolutely.
It's a game. Yeah. It's a Dungeons and Dragons, choose your own adventure game that you played as a kid. You get to go in there and think, oh, I'm going to role play today. This is going to be interesting. It's only going to last an hour and a half. I get to go home. I'm not hungry at the moment. All the things that you have. And it's amazing how quickly, half an hour in, you are really pissed off.
Yes.
And how ridiculous, how pissed off you are. And living in this world for a half an hour.
And it's not a game.
Right.
It ceases to be a game.
Right. And then you get to walk home afterwards and go back to your space and, you know, your comfort of your life and realize that really impacted me. And so,
let me just add one powerful piece of that is at the end of the simulation, there's normally a panel of individuals who have recently returned to the community, and they say, this is real. This is my reality. And when you couple, you've just gone through that experience yourself as a, quote, volunteer, and then to hear the life stories of individuals who say, this is my life, there's a recommitment of, we can do better than this.
So the idea is, this is an example of a program the city is funding. Have you seen success? You feel like this works, but it's just underfunded to be at the height of success that it needs to be?
It's not only is it underfunded in terms of staffing resources, it's underfunded. It lacks significant important resources to be able to allow the program to live up to its promise. Alder McKinney was just, she and I were just talking about this yesterday, having seen it up close and personal. This is a big concern that she's expressed. You can speak on that yourself. I don't need to speak for you.
We've had that conversation. And so oftentimes we put programs together, but we really do need to drill down deeper to make sure that those individuals that the programs are directed to, really that they are getting that access and is getting to those individuals that it's intended to, and what is that expectation. So we really need to make sure that the resources are there to really move the needle. You said that earlier, is that to move the needle, to change the dial, to make a difference. And so we've got to look broader and make sure that we're bringing in the adequate resources that can move the needle.
So on this proposal, we've talked just about a few of them so far. We'll get to more of them.
Yeah.
But the Madison Peace Project, the Communities Against Violence that we were just talking about, there's also the youth employment expansion, youth mentoring. Those are the affordable parts of your proposal.
Yeah.
And none of those are, those aren't no cost. All of those, even the Madison Peace Project of empowering youth to come up with solutions, then the city will step up and fund and support their solutions to actual implementation. That takes money.
Yeah.
Expanding all these resources, these pieces in themselves, and these are your report's low-hanging fruit, they will take effort to make success. How do you approach that?
So you're absolutely right for calling out. Some of these are, five and six figure type of investments. One that obviously comes to mind is the youth employment expansion. So last year, Alder Fair and I made a commitment publicly that, we were going to work to expand summer youth employment. And then in the last budget cycle, we did that. We doubled the number of youth that are doubled the amount of funding to be able to provide double the amount of summer jobs for youth. And in this proposal, we call on increasing it by the same increment again this year, adding support for another 115 youth. But some of these are even more ambitious than that, right? The one that Alder Fair and I called out most specifically was responding to the county's work, and this better than the two of us, but responding to the county's work of proposing a crisis restoration center, right? You guys did.
That was the number one of all the work group recommendations of the mental health, of all the criminal justice work groups the county did last year. The number one issue was a separate space besides the jail for police and community members to go, or police to take community members to when they're having a mental health crisis, in alternative to the jail, which, a side note, but I'm sure you already know this, the criminal justice system is the largest housing provider of people with mental illnesses.
Yeah.
Los Angeles County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the country, and you can keep getting smaller and smaller by community, but the largest mental health facility in Dane County is the Dane County Jail.
Yes.
So you talk about that in this proposal too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, For as much as, you know, we certainly could have come up with a list of 30 or 300 things, what we really tried to do is emphasize on things that seemed practical because they were evidence-based, practical because there was some amount of momentum for them in our community, or practical because there's the beginning of momentum for them in our community, right? So this is an example of trying to help add strength to the tremendous amount of work that the County Work Group put into looking at good ideas, getting community feedback, and asking the public to asking folks to participate in ranking the best programs, right? I mean, our community is tired of proposals that are going to sit on a shelf.
Yeah. conversations and meetings.
Conversations.
Almost all well-intentioned. Probably all well-intentioned.
Yes, I would say well-intentioned, but I ditto the fact that we've had some tremendous deep dive studies that are now sitting on the shelf and growing dust. And so as we move toward these initiatives, we have to be willing to put legs and resources toward those commitments, because we can build community centers, we can build programs, but if we don't include operational budgets, if we don't include sustainability, if we don't include those real pieces that will make a program beyond a program, but effectively changing and shifting the needle, we're right back where we started from. So
we're talking with Alder Maurice Cheeks and Alder Barbara McKinney from the Madison City Council about a recent proposal to address violence in the city of Madison and how to empower youth and many members of our community to change our city and move us in a different direction. Big picture, how do you make this not another report on the shelf? What you've written is fabulous. What you've proposed is fabulous. What the ideas are important. And just as you say, sure, there could be a million other things to the fund, but these are nine efforts that if they were funded and addressed, even half of them, they would make a difference in our community. So how then, is it political will? Is it funding? Is it both?
Maurice, talk also about prioritized budgeting. I think that that's critical conversation as well.
Yeah. So as you asked that question, Carousel, I'm reminded of a quote that Dr. King gave when he said that there is no lack of human resources. There is no deficit in human resources. The only deficit is in human will, right? Yeah, it's about political will, right? We spend a couple hundred million dollars every year as a city, and to the extent that every year the way that we approach that is through the practice of sort of cost to continue, that's not how we're going to move our community forward. That is maintaining structurally maintaining the status quo. One of the things that some of us on the council have been pushing for a while is, and I think there's receptiveness from the finance department, and I think, you know, beginning of a receptiveness from the mayor's office is moving our city to outcome-based budgeting or priority-based budgeting, where rather than looking at our budget as, well, last year we spent X millions on this department and Y millions on that department, and, you know, we want to keep a cost-to-continue model of, say, we're going to spend not more than that, or 3% less, or 1% more, or whatever the case may be, but to go through the hard process of publicly identifying what our top priorities are as elected officials and as a community for our city, and putting and bringing our budgeting process through the lens of what are our greatest priorities as a community, and what initiatives support achieving those goals, and what programs support those initiatives, and then at the bottom level, what departments support those programs, which support those initiatives, which support those goals, right? And this is increasingly common in the private sector, and gaining traction in other municipalities. This is this process of putting our money where our mouth is and articulating a vision for what do we want to be when we grow up, that's going to be really important.
You know, but that does leave, I 100% support everything you just said,
yeah.
But that leaves something on the cutting block. And I do appreciate that instead of it turning into a way of I'm cutting this and you're just sort of picking and choosing, but there are inevitably that means that there are things being funded right now that although you don't dislike the funding of them, they don't make it to your priority list.
Let me add kind of a ditto to that. One of the conversations that need to be held is the community's input on what those priorities need to
be.
I like when the county moves that deliberation process out into the community. I would say that we need to move our conversation out into the community as well. And so as we begin to wrestle with what those priorities are, it should not be the 20 of us making those decisions. It should be us going into the community, providing an outlet for individuals to come in and share where their priorities are, so that as we are struggling with how to set those priorities, it is we've listened to intently the community, and this is the community voices that are saying this is important to us. And so not having it must include those conversations
so
as well.
Here's my right. I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate, maybe a little bit of a downer, and you're gonna pull me back up. I'm certain of it. But so my 11 years on the county board, my concern is one, public important input of course is important. Absolutely can't disagree with anything being said. But two, sometimes the community that knows the meetings happening and has the most ability to get to the community meeting and feel comfortable standing up in public and saying it, they fight the loudest for a program that I'm like, well, I don't think that program's the most important, but there were a dozen people that showed up tonight to advocate for that. So how do you make sure the communities that aren't being heard today get heard?
I'm so glad that you brought that up. You are absolutely right, is that being vocal is comfortable with being vocal. What we've not been able to generate and inspire as a community is how do we begin to reach the population that is underrepresented. That is a real challenge. How do we hear from the community? And I would say there's a thought, and let me use myself as an example, is that I wanted to send my son to private school. In order to pay for that, I had to work 3 jobs to pay for that. And there were some places and spaces that I couldn't be, not because I didn't want to be, but because I could not be. And so as we are intentionally saying that we want all voices at the table, we must figure out as a city, elected official, how can we represent the entirety of our communities, and how do we get those voices? Do we know how? Is it challenging? Absolutely it is. But do we have to do it? Yes, because when we start talking about prioritized budgeting, you have to have those other voices, because if you don't, you're leaving out a whole segment of individuals who are always underrepresented.
In our couple more minutes here, Mo, what's sort of your thought of this, and then your thought of how do you move forward from here? What are the next steps that we can expect?
So what you heard in my colleague's voice there was a sense of determination, right? I think that's one of the most important takeaways from this conversation, and what I hope the public takes away from the council's taking a stance on some of these issues. Our first order of business in achieving our goals and trying to live up to being the community that we imagine we are, that we aspire to be, is becoming discontent, becoming absolutely determined to see that we are a community that works for everyone, that creates opportunities for all. really the function at the bottom of the day, at the end of the day, the function of a city, one of its unique characteristics is the power that it creates to create upward mobility. That's what a city does. People come to cities for opportunity, for upward mobility, and forever now. And for the past, you know, for certainly for the past generation, we have excelled at creating upward mobility for the top 80%. The top 80%, the most privileged in our community, they come here for university or they come here for great job opportunities. And our city has grown to accommodate and foster success for those folks. While we were doing that, while we were getting ranked as one of the best cities in America for exactly that reason, because we've excelled at that, we took our eye off of ensuring that we are a city that works for the bottom 20%, so that everyone, low-income, minority, immigrant, homeless, that when they come here, single mothers, when they come here, that they will have opportunity for upward mobility. That's not optional for our city. We can't hope to get good at that. We have to get good at that, and that's going to require change. It's going to require a level of determination that we haven't seen yet in the city, but we need to.
Well, and success at the upward mobility for the 80%, that took effort, that took planning,
absolutely,
that took thought. That doesn't happen by accident. So there's no reason to thank determination of the leaders before us, and now the leaders that I get to have the honor of talking to today are the leaders that are going to carry us to the next steps. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. This has been a fabulous conversation, and it has left me hopeful. And hopefully everyone listening will follow up and see the things as they progress. I'm sure this will take many steps on the city council floor. So thank you so much, Madison Elder Maurice Cheeks, Madison Elder Barbara McKinney. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, Tim, for
engineering, and Sarah for producing. Have a great day, everybody. See you next week.